Imagine a scenario that honestly is terrifying to even think about. You or maybe someone you love is facing a really life-threatening illness. You've been through every single approved treatment. The doctors are saying, look, there's nothing left on the table, and you don't qualify for any clinical trials. You've just hit a wall.
It's a place of profound desperation, I think. A feeling of real powerlessness. Standard medicine has just run out of options for you.
Exactly. And it's this awful reality that led to this concept here in the US called Right to Try. It's meant to be a pathway, intended anyway, to offer some kind of possibility when those standard roads are closed.
It's definitely a legislative response, isn't it? To that very human drive to just fight, to seek anything that might work when you're facing the end.
And that's exactly what we're diving into today. We've got a stack of sources here. There's an FDA fact sheet giving the official line, a pretty comprehensive Wikipedia overview that gives us history, different viewpoints.
Yeah, the pros and cons.
And also this really interesting piece out of Korea that connects this whole idea to precision medicine, even AI. Quite a different angle.
So our mission today in this deep dive is really to unpack Right to Try. Let's try and understand what it is on paper, Then see what the reported experience has actually been like in the real world. And crucially, get a handle on the core arguments from the people who champion it, and of course, those who raise some pretty significant concerns.
We need to figure out who this pathway is even designed for, what kinds of experimental treatments we're talking about, and look at the practical realities reported when patients and their doctors actually try to use it.
Okay, so let's start right there. Cut to the chase.
No.
What is Right to Try, fundamentally?
So the FDA info, it defines Right to Try as one pathway. It's important to note, not the only one, but a pathway for patients facing these life-threatening diseases or conditions. And the critical part is they have to have exhausted all the approved treatment
Right,
options
every single one.
and be unable to participate in a clinical trial for the drug they're hoping to get.
Got it. So it's really for those very specific, very dire situations. And what this pathway is supposed to unlock is access to certain investigational drugs or biologics that haven't gotten that FDA stamp of approval yet.
And just quickly, a biologic, that's something derived from living organisms, right? Like vaccines, some complex drugs. So yeah, we're talking therapy still very much under investigation.
Precisely. They haven't gone through the whole FDA approval gauntlet. And here's where it gets really distinct and honestly kind of surprising from the FDA's own materials. Under Right to Try, the interaction is directly between the patient, their doctor, and the company that's developing the drug.
The FDA makes it crystal clear. They are not involved in reviewing or approving these individual right to try requests. They basically step out of that specific process.
And that's a massive difference from other ways patients might access unapproved drugs, which, we can touch on. And this is, well, a uniquely U.S. thing, existing at both state and now federal levels. The federal law, signed back in 2018, it actually carries the names of some key advocates, the Trickett Rendler, Frank Mongiello, Jordan McLean, and Matthew Bellina Act.
Wow, quite a title, quite a legacy carried in that name. So let's dig a bit deeper into the mechanics then. Who exactly qualifies for this and what kind of treatments? The FDA fact sheet spells out the patient criteria pretty clearly.
Yeah, it's a strict list. First, obviously, you need to have a life-threatening disease or condition. That's the baseline. Second, you must have quite literally exhausted every single available approved treatment option for it.
No stone unturned on the approved front. And your doctor specifically has to certify that you can't get into a clinical trial for the actual drug you're seeking.
Exactly. That inability to join a trial is a key hurdle that RTT is sort of designed to get around. And finally, you or your legal representative have to give written, informed consent to the doctor about the specific investigational drug.
That informed consent piece feels, well, especially crucial, doesn't it, given what these treatments are or aren't yet?
Absolutely.
Now, what about the treatments themselves? What makes a drug or biologic eligible?
They have to meet certain criteria in the act itself, mainly that they are currently under clinical investigation. Our Wikipedia source adds a bit more detail there. They generally need to have completed at least phase I testing.
Okay, phase I. So that means they've probably been tested for basic safety, usually in a small group of healthy people or maybe some patients. But we're a long way from knowing if they actually work effectively for the disease or even what all the side effects might be in sicker patients.
Exactly. limited data. Which brings us to maybe one of the most significant points, something highlighted in basically all our sources, that really shapes the whole debate around RTT.
Which is?
The Right to Try Act itself explicitly says it does not require a manufacturer or sponsor the drug company to actually provide access to their investigational drugs or biologics. And echoing that point about the FDA not being involved in approvals, the FDA also cannot force a company to provide access under this law.
That's a huge point, isn't it? It gives patients the legal right to ask, maybe doctors the legal cover to prescribe if they choose.
Right.
But it offers zero mechanism, no mandate for the patient to actually get the drug if the company just says no or doesn't respond. It sounds more like a right to ask than a right to get.
Precisely. And that distinction, that gap, is really at the heart of so much of the criticism you hear about these laws.
Which leads us nicely into how this pathway is different from the more, let's say, standard ways patients might get access to investigational drugs, like through clinical trials, obviously, or something called expanded access.
Yeah, the main difference with RTT, as we just said, is that level of FDA oversight before the patient gets the drug. Normally, if a doctor wants to use an investigational drug outside a trial, say, for a patient who doesn't qualify, they'd submit what's called an investigational new drug application, or IND, to the FDA. The FDA reviews that IND application. They look at the safety data, the doctor's plan for using it, the specific patient situation, before they give the green light for that patient to receive the drug.
So the FDA is actively involved. They're assessing the risk for that specific patient under that standard IND path.
Exactly. They provide that layer of review. Under Right to Try, however, drugs generally qualify for an exemption from needing those pre-use IND reviews by the FDA.
Right. So that means for a drug someone gets through RTT, the FDA hasn't actually determined if it's safe or effective for that specific patient.
Correct.
They haven't weighed in on the potential risks, the side effects, or even if it's likely to help at all.
Which is why, as the FDA source really emphasizes, that doctor-patient conversation and the whole informed consent process become absolutely paramount. The burden of figuring out the potential risks and benefits, it falls squarely on the patient and their physician.
And you mentioned expanded access. Our Wikipedia source brings that up too, sometimes called compassionate use. That's another pathway that already exists and does involve FDA review, right?
Yes. Expanded access is another route the FDA offers for patients outside of clinical trials. And the Wikipedia source does note that, reportedly, many physicians and even drug sponsors often prefer that route.
Why is that? Do we know?
Well, the thinking might be that having the FDA review the proposed use provides a certain degree of regulatory clarity, maybe some reassurance or confidence for both the doctor and the company.
Interesting. So RTT exists alongside that, offering a different path with less direct FDA gatekeeping beforehand.
Let's switch gears slightly and look at the journey of how RTT became law. It wasn't federal to start with, was it?
No. It bubbled up from the states. Colorado was actually the first state to pass a Right to Try law way back in 2014. And from there, the movement just exploded. By August 2018, something like 41 U.S. states had passed their own versions of these laws.
41 states in just 4 years. That's incredibly fast adoption for any kind of legislation. It really is. The Wikipedia source points to the Goldwater Institute, they're a libertarian think tank, as being a major driving force behind this. They advocated strongly for these laws and even created a sort of model act that many states ended up following.
So they were really pushing it at the state level, framing it around individual liberty, I imagine.
Very much so. Then the passage of the federal law in 2018 aimed to create, you know, a more uniform system across the whole country.
Okay, so now let's really get into the heart of the debate. The powerful arguments made by those who support Right to Try, why did they fight so hard for this?
Well, for proponents, the absolute main point is access. It boils down to access. These laws are intended to provide a potential last resort, a lifeline, for patients who have literally tried everything else approved and can't get into trials.
The core argument, especially from groups like Goldwater, seems to really center on patient autonomy, doesn't it? Control over your own medical decisions, particularly when you're facing the end of life.
Exactly. They argue it allows for a kind of individualized treatment approach that maybe isn't available under this stricter existing regulatory structures.
There's also that potent ethical argument that sometimes comes up.
Yeah, the idea that if society, or at least some states, recognize a right for terminally ill patients to potentially end their lives, physician-assisted suicide, where it's legal, then shouldn't those same patients also have a right to try experimental treatments that might extend or improve their lives.
That definitely reframes the ethical landscape of the discussion, putting the emphasis on the patient's right to choose their path.
It's a powerful framing. Some proponents also draw parallels to historical patient advocacy movements, like the AIDS activism back in the 80s, where patients fought tooth and nail for access to unapproved drugs.
Right.
The Wikipedia source even mentions these sometimes being called Dallas Buyers Club bills, referencing that movie about accessing non-approved AIDS treatments outside the system.
So it taps into that idea of desperation and the feeling that patients shouldn't have to break the law or go underground to seek potentially life-saving therapies.
Exactly. And Wikipedia gives that specific example of Dr. Ibrahim Delpasand in Texas. Reportedly, he treated 78 patients with neuroendocrine cancer using a drug called LU-177 octreotate under the Texas state RTT law.
And this was after the FDA had apparently refused permission for those specific patients to be in his trial.
That's the claim. It sounds like a clear instance where RTT provided access that wasn't otherwise available.
But there's always a but, isn't there?
Well, the source adds a crucial note of caution. It's apparently disputed whether that specific drug might have actually been available through another pathway anyway, like expanded access.
So even that key example isn't entirely clear-cut proof that RTT provided truly unique access that couldn't have been achieved otherwise.
Right. That ambiguity around the practical impact, what difference it really makes on the ground, leads us straight to the other side of the debate, the arguments against right to try.
Okay, so what are the main worries? What concerns do critics raise?
Well, probably the number one criticism you hear is about the actual tangible benefit to patients. Because, as we discussed, the laws don't require the drug companies to provide the drug.
Right.
They don't require doctors to prescribe it, even if asked. And maybe most importantly, they don't require insurance companies to pay for what could be incredibly expensive experimental treatments.
So the argument from critics is that the law might give patients the illusion of hope, maybe even false hope, because it doesn't actually guarantee access or deal with the potentially crushing costs, making it seem toothless in practice.
Exactly that. Offering a right without the means to exercise it, essentially. Beyond just access, though, there are major concerns about safety and efficacy.
Because these drugs have only finished phase I testing, maybe?
Right. There's just very limited data, especially in how they'll affect patients who are already severely ill, maybe with multiple health problems, the very patients likely seeking RTT because they couldn't get into trials.
And that lack of data makes truly informed consent incredibly difficult, doesn't it? How can you really understand the risks and potential benefits if even the company developing the drug doesn't fully know them yet, especially for this specific, sicker patient population?
It's a huge ethical challenge. Critics point squarely at the significant risk of harm. These experimental drugs could potentially speed up death, they could increase suffering, cause severe unexpected side effects, all without any real proven chance of benefit.
And I think I saw something about potentially losing other care.
Yeah, some state laws reportedly even put patients at risk of losing eligibility for crucial support, like hospice or home health care, if they decide to pursue an RTT therapy. That's a terrible trade-off to face.
And the cost that keeps coming up. It's a massive unaddressed issue. These treatments can be astronomically expensive, and RTT laws don't force insurers to cover them.
No. So patients and their families could be left facing potentially ruinous medical bills for something that might not work and could even cause harm.
There are also bigger regulatory concerns, right, about the FDA's role.
Yes. Critics argue that bypassing FDA oversight, even for this specific, desperate population, weakens the agency's fundamental role in protecting public health. Some legal scholars have also questioned the constitutionality, especially the state laws, suggesting they might be overstepping by trying to regulate drugs that move across state lines, which is typically federal territory.
The Wikipedia source quotes David Gorski, who's a well-known critic in this area. He calls these laws placebo legislation, popular, makes people feel good, but functionally ineffective.
Yeah, and he goes further, suggesting their underlying goal might actually be rooted in libertarian politics,
right,
aiming to sort of neuter the FDA's ability to regulate certain drugs. That's a pretty pointed accusation about the intent behind the laws.
It certainly highlights a view that maybe the laws are more symbolic or politically motivated than practically helpful for patients. Jan Bellamy is also quoted raising concerns.
Right. Bellamy points out that RTT doesn't guarantee that patients truly have no other options left, or that the costs are appropriate, or that the informed consent process is genuinely robust, or even that there's a solid framework to assess the risk-benefit balance for each case. they highlight a lack of clear regulatory infrastructure for the RTT process itself.
And Harriet Hall's point really hits home, too, about patients maybe not fully grasping the enormous risks or the incredibly low probability of success, especially if they were deemed too sick for clinical trials in the first place, making them potentially more vulnerable to complications.
It underscores the human side of these safety concerns. The critics definitely raise substantial points about the potential pitfalls and the real-world limitations of Right to Try.
So, okay, we have these strong arguments on both sides, these practical limitations. What does the actual use of the federal RTT pathway look like since it became law in 2018? Has it been widely used?
Well, the data is apparently quite limited, but the sources we have suggest that actually very few patients have used the federal RTT pathway since 2018.
Really? Very few? That seems counterintuitive given how hard people fought for the law and the large number of patients who are theoretically eligible.
It does seem that way. But our Wikipedia source notes that many physicians and drug sponsors reportedly just continue to prefer using the FDA's existing expanded access route.
The one with FDA review.
Right. Perhaps they find that existing regulatory framework more manageable, or it offers a clearer, more established path. The source even highlights cases involving the law's own namesakes. Matt Bellino reportedly did gain access to a treatment.
Okay.
But the company apparently then wouldn't accept other patients via that RTT route. And Frank Mongiello, another namesake, has reportedly not found access through RTT. His wife is quoted saying something like, companies just don't seem to be giving away their drugs.
Wow. Those examples really hammer home that key point again. The company's willingness, their decision, is ultimately paramount regardless of the law existing.
It seems so.
What about that case of Natalie Harp? She was quite public, claimed RTT saved her life, became a vocal advocate.
Yes, Wikipedia covers that too, but it also cites experts who questioned her specific claim. They suggested it was more likely she received an already FDA-approved drug just for an unapproved use, what we call off-label prescribing.
Ah, which is perfectly legal and happens all the time and was possible long before RTT laws existed.
Exactly. So their analysis suggests her case might not actually be an example of RTT providing access to a truly unapproved investigational drug in the way the law intends.
That's an important distinction. It shows how easily these different pathways can get conflated in the public discussion. Now, the federal law does require the drug sponsors to report their RTT usage annually to the FDA, doesn't it?
Yes, they're supposed to provide a summary, things like adverse events, doses used, number of patients treated. But the Wikipedia source notes that the final official guidance for that reporting hasn't actually been released yet.
So it's hard to get a complete, totally certain picture of how much it's being used or the outcomes.
Exactly. Makes a full accounting challenging. There is one specific recent example mentioned, though, a drug called aviptidil. It was apparently used in over 500 patients with severe COVID-19 via the RTT pathway. This was after its clinical trial failed, and the FDA had already denied emergency use authorization for it.
Ah, so that case does seem to illustrate its use in a real moment of crisis, like a genuine Hail Mary option when all the other regulatory doors had slammed shut.
It seems to fit that description, yes. A last resort scenario.
Okay, let's completely shift gears now and look at that international perspective from the Korean source you shared. It offers a really different framing for this whole discussion, doesn't it?
It really does. The Korean piece framed that decision point, the one faced by a terminally ill patient, very starkly. It calls it a critical choice when facing death.
And it highlights such a powerful contrast. While the U.S., as we've spent all this time discussing, has wrestled with creating this specific legal pathway, right, to try to access unapproved therapies under certain very defined circumstances.
And you mentioned how some U.S. states like Texas, Arizona, Colorado, Montana have even supported certain commercial aspects for some patients.
Right. In South Korea, according to the source, there just isn't any legal concept like Right to Try. Requesting or providing experimental treatment commercially outside the approved regulatory processes is reportedly illegal.
And medical staff who do it can actually face punishment.
Wow. That stark difference really throws the whole tension we've been discussing into sharp relief, doesn't it? You have one system trying, however imperfectly, to carve out a space for patient choice at the end.
Right.
Versus another system maintaining very strict regulatory control, even in those final stages of life.
It's two very different philosophies on balancing regulation and autonomy there.
The Korean source then does something fascinating. It connects this dilemma to the absolute cutting edge of medicine, precision medicine, and the role of artificial intelligence.
Yeah, this is where it gets really thought-provoking. The source basically argues that while precision medicine, tailoring treatment to your unique individual biology seems like the ultimate scientific advancement.
And AIs is obviously becoming a huge tool there, helping predict drug effects, interpret complex genetic data, maybe even suggest experimental treatments down the line.
Yes. But the source argues that the true revolutionary potential of precision medicine isn't just the tailored treatment itself, it's the choice it could, and maybe should, empower the patient to make.
Meaning,
if the technology gets so good that it can identify a potentially ideal treatment for you, even an experimental one, but then legal or systemic barriers stop you from actually choosing that option.
Then, from the patient's viewpoint, the system is still fundamentally imprecise. The tech might be precise, but the ability to act on that personalized information, the actual choice, is denied.
That's a really powerful distinction they make. The source uses this great line. Technology makes life precise, but our institutions, healthcare systems, laws, regulations should make life respected.
That's quite profound, and it hammers home that point we touched on earlier. For terminally ill patients, time is just the most critical non-renewable resource.
Absolutely. Regulation is necessary, obviously, but their reality, their timeline, often moves with an urgency that standard bureaucratic processes just can't match.
Ultimately, the Korean source seems to argue that right to try, or at least the core concept behind it, isn't just about scientific progress or getting access to new technology.
No, it frames it as being fundamentally about patient autonomy, about dignity in the face of death, and about having the courage and the right to choose your path when everything else seems lost. It's really a call for healthcare systems everywhere to evolve to better support that ultimate patient choice.
That perspective adds such a vital layer, doesn't it? It moves us beyond just the legal nuts and bolts, the regulatory frameworks, to consider the deeply human, even philosophical, dimensions of this whole issue.
It really forces us to think about the so what behind all the laws and the data points. What does it actually mean for people?
Okay, so let's try and quickly pull together the main threads of this deep dive. We started with that incredibly difficult scenario hitting the end of the road with standard medical options.
And we saw how the U.S. right to try pathway emerged as one attempted answer to that, offering a legal avenue, on paper at least, for terminally ill patients who can't get into trials to seek out investigational drugs.
We unpacked the specifics, those strict eligibility criteria, the types of experimental treatments that qualify, phase I completed, and that really key point that the FDA steps aside from individual requests.
And crucially, the companies are not required by the law to actually provide the drug.
We looked at how RTT differs from other pathways like expanded access, mainly because of that reduced FDA pre-use oversight, meaning patients and doctors are navigating treatments whose safety and effectiveness haven't been vetted by the agency for that use.
We traced its history from that surprisingly rapid state-level adoption, pushed by groups like the Goldwater Institute, leading up to the federal law in 2018.
Then we explored the powerful arguments from proponents focusing on patient autonomy, control, that ethical right to try when facing death, even drawing parallels to historical patient advocacy movements.
And we weighed those against the very significant criticisms, the concerns about false hope, the practical issues of access and cost not being mandated, the serious safer concerns for vulnerable patients, the difficulties around truly informed consent, and the broader regulatory implications.
We discussed the apparently limited real-world usage of the federal pathway so far, noting that many seem to still prefer the expanded access route, and that even some high-profile examples have complexities or might not be true RTT cases.
Although we did see that Aviptadil example in COVID, illustrating its potential use as a true last resort when other doors close.
And finally, we brought in that really valuable international perspective from South Korea, contrasting the U.S. pathway with a system where such access is illegal, and connecting the whole concept of right to drum to try to bigger ideas about patient choice in the age of precision medicine, AI, and how our institutions should ultimately make life respected.
Yeah, it's clear this isn't just some dry legal or medical topic. It's intensely human. It touches on fundamental questions about individual freedom versus societal protection, about medical ethics when facing mortality, and about the role and limits of regulation when lives are quite literally on the line.
It really puts into sharp focus that core tension, doesn't it, between the desperate, understandable desire of patients and families to pursue any potential option when facing certain death.
And the necessary caution, the societal obligation to protect people from therapies whose risks and benefits are largely unknown, potentially even harmful.
it leaves us with a profound question, really, in trying to balance protecting vulnerable patients from unproven treatments, maybe even exploitation, against their fundamental desire for autonomy, for the dignity of choosing to fight with every tool available, even the untested ones. Where should society draw that line? And who is best equipped to draw it?
That's the multi-billion dollar question, isn't it?
It really is. Thinking about everything we've unpacked in this deep dive today, all the different angles and argument, what stands out most to you, the listener, from all of this?